you're a modem user and you live in the United States, now you can have quality, reliable internet access and support ACB radio at the same time. Easy Access USA gives you flat rate 56K internet access, two email accounts, and Usenet news groups for only $19.95 a month. And every month, $4 of that great price goes to ACB Radio, so we can keep bringing you your favorite shows and expanding our service. So don't delay. Switch today to Easy Access USA. Surf on over now to www.easyaccessusa.net. That's www.easyaccessusa.net. Or if you'd rather sign up over the phone, call them toll-free at 866-835-7872. That's 866-835-7872 between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern. Easy Access USA and ACB Radio, working together to bring you the best. Jonathan Mosen. We've had that music before, haven't we? This is Jonathan Mosen, and welcome to this ACB Radio pre-election debate. In about a week's time, in exactly a week's time, in fact, we will be enjoying the opening session of the 40th Annual Convention of the American Council of the Blind. At the end of that convention, there will be a new set of offices in ACB. We're here to profile the first vice presidents, first of all. There are two candidates who've declared, Sanford Alexander and Steve Spiker. And what's particularly interesting about this is that Steve has declared after the closure of the Board of Publications webpage. So for many of you, this might be the first opportunity that you've had to hear his views. We're going to start, as we have right throughout these debates, with a series of statements, or a couple of statements, one from each person, as to why they're seeking the position, what their strengths and weaknesses are, basically anything that they feel they would like to communicate to you as an opening gambit for this debate. So that's a two-minute process, and we'll say good evening to you firstly, Sanford Alexander, and you have 2 minutes to make your opening statement.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. I want to thank the ACB Board, the Board of Publications, ACB Radio, and some telephone company for being able to make this debate possible, and your patience. I've served on the Resolutions Committee for the past 4 years and was selected to serve on the Executive Committee last year. For the past 2 years, I was on the committee that prioritizes all of the resolutions to be presented to the board at the post-convention board meeting. Last year, I chaired this group. Over the past 5 years, I've attended a number of state conventions in neighboring states, as well as the NFB affiliate in Kansas, and of course, my own. So I've been to probably about 14 or 15 conventions in that time. I've worked at breaking down barriers. I've worked with the NFBK. I've worked with the Kansas Advocacy and Protective Service, the State Rehabilitation Council, the State Independent Living Council. In my work with GDUI, I participated in the historic effort to bring guide dog and service dog worlds closer together, securing the Assistance Dogs International and the International Association of Assistance Dog Partners participation in a GDUI-sponsored summit meeting held in Columbus in February. The first vice president is the assistant to the president and must support him or her in carrying out their wishes and the mandates of the membership and of the board, and will likely be deeply involved with the appointment and management of committees. Next, you sit on the board as a member of the governing body and owe the membership your best personal input. Lastly, you are the person the Constitution has charged with the responsibility to act in the president's behalf when the president is unable to do so. I have served on a number of boards over the years and have developed the skills to work with divergent views, people bringing together people from different points of view and able to find the common ground in sometimes what seems like hopeless situations. I believe deeply in the mission of the American Council of the Blind and look forward to the opportunity to serve it in this new challenging role.
Thank you very much for that. And now we say good evening to Steve Spiker and invite him to make his opening two-minute statement.
Good evening, Jonathan. I, too, would like to express my thanks to folks who have made this technically possible, to the BOP who had the vision to bring the voters more information concerning the candidates, to you, Jonathan, for the fine work you do on the radio, and to Sanford for being such an outstanding candidate for the office of First Vice President. I think ACB is truly fortunate to have the candidates it has and of their quality running. And I'm certainly looking forward to the elections and to the caucuses, which I always find fascinating and a wonderful way to stay in touch with the thoughts, the hopes, and the concerns of our ACB members. 2 years ago, I completed 9 years service on the ACB board, 4 as director and 5 as second vice president, by saying from the podium at the convention that I had some concerns about ACB's future. The number of people who came up to me to ask for specifics later in convention week was really heartening because it showed the depth of concern that a number of members have for ACB and its future. I don't mean to imply by this anything negative about the current administration or past ones. It's simply helpful, I think, when everybody, the more people we have interested in our future and what's going to happen, I think the better our chances are of not only surviving that future, but doing well in it. So even though these people had come forward and though I did have concerns, I decided at that time to step back from the National Board for a time and do some other work in ACB. I found that without any official hats last year, I was busier at the convention than I had been when I was officer liaison to 5 committees that principally operate at the convention. And I have, during that time, been working with our state affiliate here in Nebraska, making lots of mistakes and trying to learn from them. One thing I've learned, for example, is the chapters are very much like people in that they have their own personalities and really do like to be involved in decisions that affect them.
I'm actually just going to have to stop you there because we're right on 2 minutes, but we'll hopefully be able to flesh out some of the other issues that you want to discuss as we move through the debate. And in fact, Steve, I'd like to pose this next question to you. To some extent, Sanford's touched on this, but I'd like to flesh out a little further what you both perceive to be the role of the first vice president, and what qualities does one have in order to perform that role appropriately. Could you give us your thoughts on that, Steve?
As Sanford has said, our first vice president needs to be ready to step in if need be, should the president be unavailable for some reason to do something that needs to be done by the president or first vice president. But I think the first vice president is also there to help the president in a couple of particular ways. One is to keep a broad vision of the work of the organization, the direction we're going in, and how the various parts of the organization fit into that. It's very easy for the president to be snagged by all the underbrush, so to speak, and to find it difficult to keep a good view of the forest. And I think one of the jobs of first vice president would be to help keep the president's vision sufficiently broad so that details don't overrun and overshadow the broad picture and the direction we're trying to go. Another job of the first vice president is to try to warn the president of problems on the horizon and, if possible, to divert those or solve them in advance so that the president can concentrate on the many things which call on the president's attention.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Just over 1 minute. These statements, by the way, are a minute-long answers. And if you've just joined us, due to some technical difficulties, we're unable to take your calls this evening, but we hope that we'll get through some of the questions that you would like to have asked yourself, should the technology have allowed that to happen. Sanford Alexander, your thoughts on the role of the first vice president and the qualities one needs?
The first vice president is a sounding board. He's a listening post to be able to collect information, to bring it back to the president, the executive committee, and the full board. You need to be able to be a good listener. You need to be able to envision things ahead of time You need to know the people in the state affiliates, the special interest affiliates, so that as you look at staffing committees and look for committee chairs that are going to be able to carry out their functions, you have an idea of who some of the best people that you might put in those positions are. You also need to have a sense of chemistry, because as we know, you can have people that are both extremely excellent in a particular area, but if they don't have the chemistry that allows them to work with each other, that isn't going to work. And sometimes you need to have them work in different areas so that you don't lose either one of them, or you have to have a third person that you know can come in there and be the buffer between them and get both of them to be able to work effectively.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Let's go on to a question about the team that will be in place at the end of Convention 2001, and we'll pose this to Sanford Alexander first. Are there particular candidates that you are endorsing, or are there candidates that you would prefer to be working with at the end of this whole process?
Well, Jonathan, I have been asked that question by a couple of the candidates, and I have not elected to endorse any of them simply because I think that as a process of airing views and opinions, it becomes much more difficult, not impossible, but certainly more of a challenge if there has been a sense of you are siding with somebody and, you know, I won. So I think that maintaining a neutral position there makes that picking up at the post-convention board meeting a little bit simpler. So no, I have not endorsed any candidates. I would certainly be fully prepared to work with any of them that are elected and feel that, again, if I were running for president, I would be putting forth my agenda. If I'm running for first vice president, and see myself as a person that the president can lean on.
Thank you for that. And Steve Spiker, any endorsements from you?
No endorsements, Jonathan. I believe both the announced candidates have some things in common, which in the context of this question are kind of interesting, because I think their skills and their interests and mine would complement each other, whomever we elect among those two. I think both Brian and Chris are interested in technology. They have fine advocacy records and so forth. My interests lie quite a bit inside ACB, how we live and work together. Some people see that as process, but often the way we feel we are being treated is just as important as what's being done. And so I think that, you know, having a stronger organization behind the president is something I could contribute and would be happy to do for either one of the candidates.
Anyone seeking an office like this is going to be bringing particular interests that they would like to further when they get in to the position. Steve, what would be some of your first priorities if you were elected first vice president?
One of the things I enjoyed doing while on the board was finding solutions to old problems that had been nagging at us for a long time, where people's thinking, or they had come to believe that all the alternatives had been explored and there just wasn't an easy solution. The solutions we found in a lot of cases were not easy either, but they were new, they were different, and they did work. And I enjoy resolving impasses and finding ways out of impasses. I have some skills and also a history of doing that in ACB. In 1990, for example, half the affiliates showed up having violated credentials rules in some respect or another, so we were looking at the possibility that half the convention couldn't be seated. With the help of the Credentials and Constitution Committee, we worked around that. And other things through the years have taken a similar course. For example, reaching a consensus on the board, which resulted in the Virginia Association of the Blind becoming an affiliate. So one of my interests is to help find new solutions in that way, and also to get us, if we can, to think more seriously and in a more organized fashion about our future.
Thank you. And your first priorities, if you were to be first vice president, Sanford?
Jonathan, I think that in coming into the role, one of my overall priorities would be making sure that the importance of what we're doing isn't lost on anybody, that ACB is not a social club. It's a very important advocacy organization, and the things that it does or the things that it doesn't do have profound impact on blind people. in light of that, I think there's several things that are happening in the world right now that are particularly important to us, and they're not necessarily by a long stretch all of them, but pedestrian rights. We have tools that are now being put in place that will enable us, if we make the right moves at the local levels, to capitalize on some breakthroughs that ACB has actually been able to champion for making roads safer for blind and visually impaired and other people. Information access in its various forms is very critical. We're dealing with a whole host of subtopics in there, and just to touch on one...
I'm going to have to stop you before you do, because we're just well over a minute there, and I must stop and be fair to everybody, but we'll get back to those. Let me just ask you two financial questions. I'll make it clear that I'm asking two, because it's a complex subject, and we want to give you ample time. The first one relates to the apportioning of the cake that we currently have, and the second one relates to making the cake bigger. So first, let's talk about the existing resources that ACB has access to. And we'll start with you, Sam, for Alexander. Do you believe that ACB uses the financial resources that it currently has appropriately, or would you like to see some areas of ACB getting more or less attention than they currently are?
Jonathan, appropriately is a time-sensitive issue. Appropriate today, absolutely. If it would be something that would not be appropriate tomorrow, mechanisms are in place and are employed to make changes. The Board of Directors receives on a monthly basis a report from the Chief Financial Officer that tracks expenses and tracks income and gives us an opportunity to see that the things that we have projected are really pretty close to target, and if they're starting to drift off, we don't have to wait for 6 months or a year to suddenly try to come up with steps that create, avoid disaster. So I think that we are using the resources effectively, and that the ability to change emphasis in those resources use is in place and is used.
What are your thoughts on that, Steve?
I think that to limit the idea of resource to financial resources is or can be part of a problem that we'd be better off avoiding. And the reason for that is, I believe, one of the principal resources we have and principally underused resources we have is the people of ACB. In terms of the financial resources we have, I know when I was on the board, there were some issues that I thought would, if resolved certain ways, would allow us to make much better use of what we had. But in terms of dealing with the cake and figuring out how big it is, one of the key questions is, what do we want to do? The amount of money in your bank account is pretty academic unless you have in mind the kind of work you want to do or what you want to buy. And only then can you know whether you have enough or not. I'm not at all clear that a majority of the board has a common understanding of exactly what ACB's priorities are. Or if they do, that understanding has been communicated to the membership. If those two things happen, I think we'd be in much better position to answer your question.
All right, bang on a minute. Very good. Let me move to the next question, and that does relate to making the cake bigger, and we'll start with you in this instance, Steve. What does ACB need to do so that it's not so limited by financial resources in terms of the goals that it pursues and the outcomes it achieves?
I think there are a number of places in ACB where we have come to a place where the old ways of doing things are considered to be the only ways of doing things, and that often narrows and limits our thinking about what we can do. So one key to getting more miles to the gallon, if you will, from the resources we have is to be clear about what we're doing and to focus on what exactly are the priorities. Also to look ahead and, if you will, prepare the road so that when we arrive there, we won't be breaking trail. We'll be traveling on ground that has been prepared. We need to send scouts up the valley, if you will, to see if there's higher ground in case the floodwaters arise. Our people, I think, are very much underused. A number of them seem to think that they are not wanted in the circles of decision-making. That really does need to change, because we have wonderful people in ACB, and if they ever become united in the way that they can, I think we can accomplish tremendous things.
Thank you for that. And Sanford Alexander, your thoughts?
the membership all around the country provide a fuel and a mechanism and a will, if we can get it all harnessed, to do great things. The desire has to be supported with the ability. One of our problems in ACB is that we are able, because we live with them, to see the problems and see the things that we need to address and need to be able, in the short run, to focus on which are the ones that are time sensitive. If we don't take care of something that may not be as critical as another thing but is not handled today, will be lost, you need to do that. If it's another issue that over the long time you can let it go a little bit, pick it up, you need to do that. And in the long term, I think we have to look at being able to expand our income, look at sources that we've shied away from for a number of historical reasons that might open up more channels of revenue for ACB that would enable us to make that number of priorities you could address at one time larger in number.
Okay. Let me just pick up on something that Steve mentioned and put this question to both of you. Do you think that ACB is a sufficiently inclusive organization, Sanford?
ACB is the consumer organization that has made itself open to visually impaired people openly and willingly and embrace them as full equal partners in our efforts. It is an organization that has looked at special interest groups that cover a variety of topics and interests, and has certainly not blocked anybody from coming in. It has almost, in a way, in doing that, made it very difficult for some folks, because in coming into ACB, sometimes figuring out where you best can use your talents and where your time can best be spent is a bit of a challenge. I could belong to about 6 or 7 special interest groups without any question of their being relevant to me, but I certainly couldn't give any of that number anything worthwhile, because I'd be spread too thin.
Steve, ACB, is it a sufficiently inclusive organization?
I hope that we can come to the place where we think of ourselves as a really big tent and do permit inclusion of all sorts of groups. We've had 2 recent examples of some difficulty in that area, one being with the Virginia Association of the Blind, where the board was rather sharply divided about whether it was possible to have or permissible to have 2 affiliates in one state, even though we already had several situations like that. The other was the discussion on ACB list last year concerning BFLAG, the Blind Friends of Lesbians and Gays, where there was clearly a strong emotion expressed about inclusion of a sort. The reason I hope we can become a big tent is that if we learn how to handle differences among ourselves and become a real community, then we can tell our sighted friends and neighbors how to handle the differences they see between them and us, and it'll be a lot easier for us to become part of their community.
There's a lot of material out there about consumer organizations, and there's also a lot of cynicism out there as well. You sort of hear people, particularly on email lists, talking about a plague on both their houses. Somehow there's a lot of cynicism. I wonder whether you could start us off, Steve, by talking about what ACB needs to do to reach out to increase its membership.
As far as I could calculate from figures of the American Foundation for the Blind about the number of visually impaired people in the country, and of course taking the National Federation and ACB at their words about their memberships, it's something over 97% of visually impaired people in the U.S. who are not affiliated with either organization. That should tell us something. I think one of the keys, we have to decide whether we really want 8 million members in the organization. Is that consistent with what we do? Or is it enough to serve those people with a smaller number of people as members? I don't know of any organized thinking going on about that, but let's say we do want them in. How do we reach out? I think one of the keys is we have to go meet them where they are. not expect them to adopt our agenda, but to find out what their agenda is and see if we can speak to that.
Your thoughts, Sanford?
People who are blind or visually impaired want to live on their street and be the neighbor next door, the Mary or John down the block, and have their blindness be a secondary thought, not my blind neighbor next door type of thing. And I think a lot of people have confused achieving that kind of anonymity in society with being involved in an advocacy organization that secures the rights and secures the tools that will actually, in fact, enable you to achieve that goal. So I think we need to reach out more to people in terms of having them understand that the things that ACB gets involved in are going to have profound impact on them, whether they're in the organization or not, and that having their input before the fact is going to make things a lot simpler. And I think as the population gets older and as the pressure on resources nationally becomes more strained, that the need to be able to do this is even going to increase.
Thank you very much. You know, every leader in a consumer organization had their first chapter meeting at some stage or another. Everybody was a newbie. And yet there's some kind of aura, I think, that sometimes surround consumer leaders that poses the danger of them being almost unapproachable, not seen as part of the rank and file. I wonder if we could start with you, Sanford, by talking about what you would do to ensure that you are accessible to grassroots members without being so swamped that you wouldn't be able to function as a leader.
The president and the vice presidents have a particular obligation to be more public than perhaps some of the other members of the board can be. I think it's a question of making sure the membership, the agencies around the country, the Council of State Administrators, all the people that are involved in the blindness field, recognize that you're there, that you're available, that you're accessible, and that when they call you or drop you an email, you're going to respond to it. I don't know that there are enough days in the week for anybody to say, I will make sure I contact every member in every organization, and I don't know that would be productive, because there's a lot of the membership that doesn't feel a need to be contacted but wants to know that when they reach out, they will be responded to.
Thank you very much, Sanford. And Steve Spiker, your thoughts on this?
Well, accessibility is a wonderful thing and certainly something we should work toward. Some things are simple. For example, at the banquet, one choice is to sit at the head table and another choice is to sit out with all the rest of the folks out yonder there and gather together the board when it's time for the photographers to do their work. And during the convention, the way it's set up now and the obligations the officers have makes it very difficult to spend a lot of time with people at the convention, though that's a priceless opportunity to work with people and to listen to them. Some of my most enjoyable moments at conventions have been working with first-timers, whether it's orientation to the program, orientation to the hotel, just telling them a little bit about ACB. And I think all of the officers and board and leaders would really enjoy that sort of thing if we could arrange our schedules to do it. I think we ought to work harder to make that possible. In affiliates, we just have to be clear with affiliates and other people about what the best way to communicate with us is. For some people, that's different. I would get better at reading my email every day, but if someone really wants to tell me something, a phone happens to work a lot better for me.
Okay, let's move on to the question of electoral reform. And I raise this because there's been some very interesting debate on the ACBL list on this very subject. About this time for the last 2 years, in fact, I think prior to last year's convention it was talked about, and it's being talked about again. Sanford, do you have an interest? Well, let me put it this way. Do you think there's a need for electoral reform within the ACB? And if so, how would that be brought about?
I believe, Jonathan, that the Constitution and the bylaws and the process that has gone into the process as it exists today has been done very carefully to reflect the uniqueness of ACB. At this time, you're balancing state affiliates and special interest groups and individual at-large members. You're balancing large groups and small groups. There's a whole host of factors, and it's an easy thing to say we need to change things, but changing, when you get into the details where the devil usually lives, you find that there's problems with all of them. We're looking at this right now in GDUI, and when you start trying to actually cobble together what will work that's different than what you're doing, you find that it is a process that needs to be looked at very carefully. I'm absolutely in favor of reviewing it, looking at it, and being open to change, but I don't think that we need to do anything without very careful thought.
Your thoughts on electoral reform, Steve?
I agree with Sanford. The caution is indicated here. The people who put this system together worked very hard on it, and one of the issues that's kind of nagging beneath the surface in ACB and really needs to be addressed and resolved so we can move on is the relationship of state and special interest affiliates and what role each of those has to bring to ACB. I'm one of those who believes that both types of affiliates have something unique and irreplaceable to offer ACB and that we need to foster and strengthen both kinds of affiliates. Tinkering with the voting system has great potential for damaging those relationships, and I think we'd want to be very, very convinced that a change was going to make us better off. If we save time by a change in voting, what do we do with the time? Do we have two more resolutions? Do we have another speaker? Let's make sure we get value for value if we make any exchange, and I agree with Sam for the caution is in order.
Now that we've warmed up, let's look at a bit of a toughie here, and we'll start with you, Steve. I wonder if you could talk to me about what you perceive to be the most pressing, the most significant advocacy issue facing the ACB today.
I believe the most pressing advocacy issue we have is to strengthen our ability to act locally. Because decision making is being decentralized in Washington in many areas, and of course, in order to act locally, we need to build up the strength of the local affiliates and do appropriate training. But I suspect that trend of decentralization will continue, and the things we need to do are to strengthen the affiliates and also get more of our people out in the community in whatever capacity, whether it's going to the grocery store, serving on local committees. The more sighted people and other people we know in our communities and the more they know and like us as people, as Sanford says, secondarily to the sight issue, the more influence we're going to have on the way things happen locally.
Sanford, your answer to this tough question.
Yes. Kansas is looking with great admiration and a touch of envy at Nebraska, that was able to successfully get a Commission for the Blind bill through a year or so ago and actually now is in the process of having to defend it now that some of the legislators that let it get through suddenly realize that maybe they want to try and get some power back. But I think what it underscores is the fact that categorical services for individuals who are blind or visually impaired is a very key advocacy issue for all of us all over the country, because history has shown us over and over again, we've had national leaders come out when we were in an earlier stage of our struggle in Kansas to tell us over and again that it just doesn't work as well when you have your umbrella agencies and you're swallowed up in the general agency completely. And we don't need to repeat history over again to prove it yet one more time.
All right. A couple of relationship questions now, and we'll start with Sanford on this one. The first relates to ACB's relationship with the National Federation of the Blind. I know that President Edwards has expressed some regret at the turn of events in recent times. It seems to have escalated rhetoric, certainly from one side of this. And there is a feeling among average blind people that I detect on email lists that says that maybe this is confusing government entities and organisations that are being lobbied when you have two major blindness organisations purporting to be consumer advocacy voices at loggerheads. Sanford, could you talk about whether you perceive a need to improve relations with the NFB, and if so, how would that come about?
For hours, Jonathan. When I went to the NFB of Kansas convention about 5 years ago, and in the microcosm of the bigger picture, said, look, you know, we've been thwarting each other's efforts with the legislature for our versions of a commission bill, and we know we're good at killing each other's legislation, and we're giving the legislators a dodge, a place to hide. X, you say X, you guys say Y, we don't know, so we won't do anything. That happens, I think, on the national level, and I think President Edwards has been very clear in saying that we need to be able to move on the areas where we can agree, and on the areas that we can't agree, reserve the right to say we've got a different opinion, but try as much as possible to find the 85 or 90% of things that we have in common and work on those, and leave the things that we can't agree on a back burner or at a caucus room between the two organizations or something like that.
Well, your hours are up there, Sanford, and we'll ask Steve to talk for a minute on relations with NFB.
I think it's a general rule we certainly should work with them where we can. We should also learn from them where we can. NFB does some certain things very, very well, and it wouldn't hurt us all to learn about their successes and their failures and adapt what we learn to our own style, which is considerably different. Another thing I think we should be aware of is that the relationship between NFB and ACB is often quite different nationally than it is locally. At times when things heat up nationally, you'll find in some areas quite a bit of cooperation on the local level because the people know and like each other, and they recognize their common interests, and they all point to Washington and say, what are they fighting about? You know, this is something we should really foster and really push, because those are people. They are colleagues of ours, in a sense, although of a different persuasion on certain matters. We do have a tremendous amount in common, and making better relations and more long-term relations at the local level, whether it's going to the legislature, whether it's going to a bingo game, whether it's having a hayrack ride or a swimming party or whatever, just being on better terms with the local people who have the same interests we do, I think will help us in the long run.
Another relationship question, then, is to do with wider, sometimes called cross-disability issues. Could you talk to us, Steve, about ACB's place in the wider disability sector, whether it wants to be a part of that or whether it should go it alone, whether there are dangers in these cross-disability coalitions?
Well, there are certainly dangers in any coalition. As the King of Siam said, and the King and I, if my ally is strong enough to protect me, might he not protect me out of all I own? And so there are certainly dangers in alliances, but there are great opportunities as well. Working on pedestrian safety here, when we started calling around to local business, to people with other disabilities, support started literally buzzing out of the phone. We heard from people we would never have heard from if we had stayed up with a blindness-only focus. I think it's amazing what kind of community support can be granted and can be acquired and put together by simply looking beyond the issue of blindness. Certainly there are areas where we will disagree with some folks, but that just means we have an opportunity to work out a solution that works for all of us.
Your thoughts on this one, Sanford?
If we don't work in larger cross-disability groups, we risk the likelihood of being lost in the crowd and forgotten about. If we do work with cross-disability groups and are not careful of protecting our principles and our needs, we run the risk of getting swallowed up in their bigger picture. Historically, when you look back at passage of the Rehab Act in 73, that didn't have regulations promulgated until 4 years later, It was cross-disability efforts that got it passed and got those regulations pushed through. In 1990, ADA got through because there was a great effort in cross-disability effort. Today, there's a major danger because some of the cross-disability agents are working in independent living centers that feel that they need to be the driving force in the rehab system, and if we don't make sure that their desire to take control of the rehab money in the next reauthorization act, as they tried the last time and were not successful, we may see a lot of programs like the older age, programs for older blind getting disappeared.
Thank you. Let's talk about, oh gosh, you know, it just popped out of my head. I'll have to look at my notes. There we go. You're listening to a debate between candidates for first vice president of the American Council of the Blind. And if you've tuned in late, we regret that we're unable to take calls this evening. So we hope we're doing a reasonable job of asking the questions that you would like to have answered. I'd like to talk about the question of service provision. There are some people who say that blind people are in the very best position to run their own services because we know our own needs better than anyone. There are those who also say that while that may well be true, that should be kept quite separate from a consumer organisation, because if you're a consumer organisation, then how can you be a service provider as well and retain integrity? I wonder whether you believe that ACB should look at being involved in service provision in any way, Sanford.
The danger in being a service provider and then trying to watchdog or critique those services is that you're going to tend to protect the service because you're running it. The other side of the coin, however, is that if you have services that are responding to the needs that you know exist, you have a better chance of having them meet them. Over the years, and we have a committee now that is looking at the vehicle that was put in place to help bridge this gap was the National Accreditation Council, which was supposed to be able to be the independent agent that could do both. It could be the watchdog for the consumers who had input to the process, and it could be the guiding force for the agencies to make sure that they were responsive. But NAC over the years has withered and suffered under an onslaught by the National Federation, and at this point I'm not sure it can fulfill that role.
I just have to stop you there, in fairness. Steve Sparker, your thoughts on service provision by consumer organizations?
I think there are things we can do to increase the freedom of individuals from reliance on government services without ourselves becoming a service provider. There are many things we can teach each other and learn from each other. And there are ways that we can enlist private entities and private resources to work on the skills. Of course, those people need to be brought up to speed on the technical aspects. And I'm not suggesting, for example, that you go to your local kennel and ask them to start training guide dogs. That's not what I'm talking about. But you know, I think there are a number of ways that we could proceed to make sure that people don't have to rely solely on government for the services they need and for acquiring and maintaining the skills they need. That reliance leaves us with only one option, and as lawyers say about going into court, when you ask the government to decide your fate, you give up most of the control over your own future.
I'd like to, that question, by the way, was a direct result of having a look at the candidates' statements, and I'd like to take a look now at another issue that was raised in some of these statements, and that is the long-term viability of ACB Radio. And I wonder if you could talk, Steve, about whether you have any thoughts about ACB Radio in terms of its becoming revenue neutral or even more than paying for itself. Do you believe, for example, that there should be a commercial element to ACB Radio?
Well, it's an interesting question because once we get that resolved, we could move on to ask the same question about the Braille Forum, which certainly doesn't pay for itself either currently, but maybe ought to. Or what about the convention? Should the convention pay for itself? Typically, the board has been very reluctant to suppose that any of these activities ought to be able to carry their own financial weight. And I think we ought to be careful about setting that position in stone. ACB Radio is too valuable a thing to leave it hostage to a particular way of thinking if we can come up with some alternatives that fit in with our philosophy and our mission. So I would hope that people remain flexible on that issue, and there are certainly difficult balancing issues to address there. I know we have good people on the Board of Publications and elsewhere in ACB who are very concerned about this. The promise of ACB Radio is great, and I certainly hope we can pursue it in a way that does make it viable long term.
Sanford, your thoughts?
Yes, Jonathan, you have to close your ears for a second. ACB Radio is one of the greatest things that has ever happened. It may ultimately be seen as ranking among the development of Braille and the development of the guide dog for blind people and visually impaired people all around the world. You know, it's very humbling to know that we're being heard not just in the United States but around the globe and sharing some of our principles with people all over. And that's kind of incredible. And they've got a lot to teach us, too, I'm sure. And what I was saying in my posting was that this tool it can't be held hostage. I don't want to see the board say if it doesn't pay for itself, we're not going to be able to expand it. But I am saying that it seems to be a vehicle that screams marketability and that we need to be able to figure out how to do that.
Oh, excellent. Right on a minute. Thank you for that. Let's take a look at ACB's internet strategy generally, because obviously I'm not in touch with any of the people who say this because they're not on the internet, but there is a concern out there that with initiatives such as the one that we're participating in right now and the Board of Publications webpage, which those who do have access to it think is a fantastic initiative, that maybe we're creating haves and have-nots. Is that a concern, or is the answer simply to encourage greater availability of internet technology, Sanford?
We have struggled with this as a society in so many things. When the automobile was new, not everybody could afford one, and did you not have automobiles until everyone could? So that's one piece of it. Another thing I think we have to realize is that the technology and information world that we're in right now is changing at such a rapid pace that things that are seeming so impossible today are going to be within reach in a couple of years, maybe less than that. Palm tops, all kinds of being able to use the telephone to dial into the internet. There's a whole host of things that are coming that will bring the technology down to the person who right now is not in that loop. And I think by those who can be there pushing the envelope, making it happen, it's going to speed the day that that happens. If we don't do it, we're going to have toasters and coffee makers and washing machines that are completely inaccessible to us because we did not have the ability to push for the technological accommodations that we need.
Steve Spiker, ACB's internet strategy, your thoughts on that?
We claim to represent in ACB all blind and visually impaired people. That covers a group of folks, quite a number of whom find computers very difficult to deal with. One answer, of course, is to go to a friend's house and gather around the friend's computer. But that doesn't always work, and we wouldn't want people to be dependent on that sort of arrangement. Certainly the Internet has promise. Certainly that promise should be explored. But this is an organization of people, and we must not become an organization of button pushers, just pushing new and brighter buttons because they're there and because they're pretty. I don't mean to demean anything that's gone on the Internet. I think what we've done on the Internet has been very valuable. But one of the things we have not done on the Internet is learn how to listen. We're getting much better at getting information out. Can we get better at listening to our constituency by being organized about how we approach the Internet and the flood of information Can we listen? Can we monitor what's going on? And can we adapt to that if we want to grow?
I'd like to talk now about the subject of ACB's democracy, and we'll start with you on this, Steve. Could you give some comments to us on the balancing act that I guess must take place between having enough autonomy between conventions to be effective as an organization versus preserving the very principles of democracy which caused ACB to be founded in the first place?
It's a very difficult challenge. Democracy is not very efficient, typically. And, of course, the pace of things in Washington and elsewhere is sometimes quite rapid. One of the answers to that is to get ourselves to a position where we're not always reacting to the latest legislative initiative by someone who's not very friendly to us. We need an advocacy arm, whether committee or whatever, that looks years ahead and starts preparing situations and telling us alternatives and helping us choose priorities, so that something may happen that we say, well, yeah, that's kind of important, but it's really not on the priority screen, and we're focused elsewhere. And we have to, one of the reasons I think the long-range plan that we had in 95 did not work and was not pushed forward is that the board adopted it, but we never asked the membership really to adopt it. There are those who say that it was voted on by the convention, but I've not been able to find any record of that in the minutes. I think we really have to bring the membership along, because there's only a certain number of times you can yell, emergency, emergency, call your congressman, and have people respond in full force.
Okay, thank you for that. Steve Sanford, your thoughts on this question?
And we must ask for people's permission.
Okay, just stop you there and ask for Sanford's comments.
Yes, as Steve said, democracy is not efficient. It sometimes is quite messy, but it is the best form of government that we can hope for and should support. I think where people have problems is confusing democracy with implementing policy. And just as the board and the executive director need to be able to have flexibility to respond to things as they come up, they need to be able to do so within the policy that's been set forth for them. And if that is happening, there's not a contradiction at all taking place. As policy changes, then what your options are to react in certain circumstances are certainly going to change as well. But democracy gives us the ability for the body to set the direction, point the road, and say, that's the road we want you to go on, and the things we're talking about, those elements that come up along the way, are not policy, they're practice that need to be dealt with on a day-to-day basis.
We are speaking with the candidates for first vice president of the American Council of the Blind, at least those who have declared to date, and they are Steve Spiker and Sanford Alexander. I have one more question, and then we'll go to your closing statements. That relates to the really low profile that blindness issues of a political nature seem to get in the media. They don't often get sufficient traction to really make a splash on the front page. What can ACB do to increase the media's interest in the profile of blindness and perhaps disability issues in general, Sanford?
Jonathan, in 1974, I was involved in a voter registration day in Philadelphia, and we had television folks that actually did come down to the library where it was being held, and they were there for a little while, and nobody came in, and we said, we recognize that you have other things you need to do, and would you want one of us to go through a registration process? They said, no, that wouldn't be real, and we can't stage it. That's one piece of the problem. Another thing, frankly, blindness most of the time isn't gory enough, isn't stark enough. That seems to be what drives our media today, the sensational things that go on. And we're trying to fix a lot of mundane things that just don't get their attention. We got attention a few conventions back when the Magoo issue was kind of running around, but that was, you know, that was kind of sexy.
excuse me, I'll just stop you there because we're well over a minute. Let me ask you the same questions, Steve, about the media profile of blindness issues.
Well, it said that working with government, and I think this is true with the press too, is like hunting a wild game. You have to know where it feels pain, and you really ought to be sure that you do want its full attention. Making blindness a loud issue on the front covers of newspapers can be counterproductive. I think we need to think very carefully about that. Because in a lot of our work, we're trying to get people to disregard the blindness and think of us as people, as ordinary people who contribute to our society and our communities. And who deal with blindness as other people deal with height or body shape or other things that may inconvenience them from time to time. So I think if loudness is the goal, there are certainly things we could do. There are public relations firms who know how to do that. But I'm not sure that loudness and visibility ought to be the goal. I think we ought to decide what we want to accomplish and then determine whether the press is the best instrument and the best arena in which to get that work done.
Well, that concludes the questions that that I have, and if you've just tuned in late, apologies that we're unable to take calls for these debates this evening due to a technical error, but we'd like to move on to the closing statement phase now, and because we asked Sanford to go first, we'll ask Steve if he would like to lead us off with a two-minute closing statement.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'd like to again thank the BOP and ACB Radio for making these debates possible. And I look forward to meeting with a number of our listeners in Des Moines at the caucuses. What I bring to the board is not an overwhelming knowledge of blindness issues. There are people who know more about the Uniform Braille Code or guide dog training or any number of other issues than I do. What I do bring, though, is an ability to ask questions that other people haven't asked yet, to look at things in ways that other people haven't looked at them yet. And to build consensus, to bring people along to new ideas. Some of the things that have resulted from some of the ideas I had have been that we now have accessible media bylaws and constitution amendments at the convention, where we didn't back before 1989, at least when I was at those conventions. We have a credentials system that permits affiliates to be seated even when they have transgressed the credentials rules. We have an index of resolutions which the board can consult in order to make sure it's not acting contrary to the wishes of the convention. A number of other things which are in my candidate statement, which has been circulated to all the affiliate presidents. I would ask the voters for their permission to come back and continue this work of innovation, of broadening our vision in ACB, of getting us unstuck from time, where we're so focused in the present and on our past that we don't talk and don't think much about our future. That would be one of my main goals, to help the board, try to persuade the board and the president to give our future at least as much attention as we give our past, and to plan our present so that when we arrive in our future, it will be a future that we have chosen, a future that we have designed, a future in which we are comfortable and proud to be there.
And to give his closing statement, here's Sanford Alexander. You have 2 minutes, Sanford.
Well, again, thank you, Jonathan, for doing a fair and thorough job in moderating the candidates' debates, especially under tonight's arduous conditions. I have no doubt that everyone seeking office has good intentions, values ACB, and wants to do a fine job, but good intentions are not enough to move the ball up the field. What we do is important and has profound impact on the lives of blind and visually impaired Americans. I have not in the past, do not now, or ever will consider the time I devote to ACB activities simply to be a good use of my spare time. I realize that what I do to advance any issue, confront any challenge, or study any question will be something that affects me as much as everyone else. I have demonstrated the ability to work with people holding different, sometimes diametrically opposed positions, and to be able to find the common ground all could stand upon without sacrificing principles. I believe we cannot afford to operate under decisions that lose purpose because of a compulsion to follow process. There are many challenges facing ACB Americans who are blind or visually impaired. There are many challenges facing ACB in terms of how best to address as many of these without losing sight of any of them. We need to find ways to improve our performance that will enable us to more effectively use our limited resources while at the same time developing new ways of expanding those resources. We need to identify ways of being able to increase our membership and help them to be more active contributing members. The first vice president of the American Council of the Blind must be an able leader, a full participating member of the board, and a pillar upon whom the president can heavily lean. I believe my experiences have shaped my development in a way that makes me the best candidate to fill the bill, and I ask for your support in earning the right to prove this assertion.
That was bang on 2 minutes. Thank you very much, and thank you both for the way that you've made yourselves available in trying circumstances this evening, and we'll look forward to seeing you both in Des Moines in just a few days' time. It's very close now.
See you there, Jonathan.
Okay, bye-bye now. And you've been listening to the candidates for the position of first vice president of the American Council of the Blind, and they were Sanford Alexander and Steve Spiker. Hope that you enjoyed that, and once again, our apologies that we were unable to invite your questions due to a technical issue that we were unable to resolve because it was beyond our control. We are now going to see if we can rustle up the candidates for president in the same way that we have been able to for first vice president. That requires me to play you some music, and I'll come back shortly. You're listening to ACB Radio Mainstream. Here's Billy Joel.
Saturday, and the manager gives me a smile, 'cause he knows that it's me they've been coming to see, to forget about life for a while.
Not broadcast.
This is Steve Mazura.
It's Robin from the Aussie Kaleidoscope.
Living on the edge.
I'm Roger Cool.
The KJS Show.
Hi, this is Patrick Perdue from
the ACBRI DJs are hard at work creating personal web pages about their shows, the music they play, and even a bit about themselves.
Now we're accumulating these web pages into the ACB Radio Interactive Broadcasters Web Ring, where you can learn more about the personalities behind the microphone. Go to www.acbradio.org, then choose the interactive link. From there, you can choose the link that will take you to the ACB Radio Interactive Broadcasters Web Ring.
And welcome to the final of our pre-election debates specials. In just under 2 weeks, the American Council of the Blind will be choosing a new leader. So far, we know of two people who are seeking that office, and they join us for the final debate of this series. The candidates for president are Brian Charlson and Chris Gray. They both join us on the line, and we will adopt the normal format for these debates, which means that we'll ask them to give an opening statement of 2 minutes. Then there'll be a series of questions, and they will have a minute to answer those questions. Unfortunately, if you've just joined us, we will be unable to take your questions this evening. We'll start in alphabetical order and invite Brian Charlson to make an opening statement. Good evening to you, Brian, and you have 2 minutes.
Good evening, Jonathan, and good evening to all of you ACB radio listeners this evening. I'm speaking to you this evening not from my home state of Massachusetts, but from New York City, where I'm attending a meeting of the American Foundation for the Blind Board of Trustees, and I'm speaking to you on a cell phone in a hotel room. Tonight I wanted to share with all of you why I feel that I'm the right person to lead ACB during the next 2 years as its president. Simply, it's because I think I come to this position having prepared myself over the course of the last 20 years to serve ACB in all of the different capacities that a president is asked to serve. I've served the organization on each and every level, from being a member of my local chapter and active in that capacity in two different state affiliates out in Oregon and in Massachusetts, on the state level in leadership capacities, having been the president of the Massachusetts affiliate and served as the treasurer of the Oregon affiliate, and on the special interest affiliate level as well, where I was one of a number of very special people who had the opportunity to act as president of the National Alliance of Blind Students, ACB student affiliate. In all of those different capacities, I've had the opportunity to learn about ACB's finances as treasurer, as the chair of the budget committee, and as an active member of the ACBES, that's the Thrift Store Board of Directors. I've had an opportunity to get to know the legislative capacity of ACB by speaking before committees of Congress on ACB's behalf, on attending legislative seminars in Washington, D.C., sponsored by ACB. I've also had an opportunity to participate in ACB's international activities as one of the two representatives from ACB on the North American Caribbean Region Board of the World Blind Union.
That just concludes the 2 minutes there, Brian, so we'll come back and talk some more throughout the course of the debate, and we'll invite Chris Gray to make his opening statement. Good evening to you, Chris.
Good evening. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Good evening to you, and good evening, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here this evening, and I am seeking support to be the next president of ACB. Let me talk first about some of my ACB experience. I have been the president of four different affiliates in ACB, two state and two special interest affiliates. I joined the American Council of the Blind through the State of Washington affiliate when it was formed in 1971, so this year is my celebration of 30 years of ACB membership. I was actually 17 when I joined, but the lawyers looked the other way. I have served as chairman of the ACB Board of Publications, and while I was chair, we had the unenviable pleasure of producing, as a committee, three issues of the Braille Forum, and I mention that as just one thing that I achieved in ACB that I think proves that I'm willing to work for the organization and, in fact, have in the past. I chaired the Durwood K. McDaniel Membership Committee that brings a new person into two new people to ACB each year. Right now I work on the History Committee, and in that job it's been my pleasure to cull through literally hundreds of hours of tape-recorded material for the organization about the founding of ACB, the events leading up to it, and it's given me a good grounding in the history of ACB. I have a commitment to achievement, a commitment to excellence in the work that I do. In my employment life, I worked at Telesensory, where I was in charge of the product that had the highest gross margin, made the most money for the company. I've worked for IBM. I've worked for Oracle. And I offer these skills and abilities to the membership of ACB, and a commitment to the membership of this organization to hold the office of president. Many positions I've tried to list.
I'll just have to stop you there because we're just over 2 minutes, and we'll come back and talk some more during the course of the debates. This is the candidates' debate for president on ACB Radio Mainstream. We'll move on to some questions now, and I'd like to ask first to get the candidates to talk about what the president actually does in an organization as democratic as the American Council of the Blind. What kind of influence can the president have? To what degree can the president set the tone? Chris, could you start us off with this?
Well, the president is sometimes in an unenviable role of being able to do the least and yet trying to affect the most. I think first and foremost, a president has to offer the skill of leadership to the organization. The president has to be a consensus builder for the organization and try and find, in many ways, the best answer to certain situations. Something that I can also offer as president is my ability in administration. I have a master's degree in administration, and there is the administrative oversight of ACB that has to be very significantly taken into account. As president, it's necessary to facilitate the activities of the organization, keep things running, make sure that things are done well. I think, though, that the most important single thing the president does is provide leadership and provide a vision for what ACB needs to be and where we need to go.
Thank you, Chris. Brian, your thoughts on the role of the president?
The president needs to be one thing in particular, and that is a team builder. ACB's presidents are not the authority figures that some organizations have taken it upon themselves to follow. Rather, they are simply a leader of leaders, a leader of the membership, trying to pull together the skills of an incredibly diverse and talented group of people that make up the 25,000 members of the American Council of the Blind. It's been my privilege, while being first vice president of ACB, to help our current president, Paul Edwards, in pulling together the more than 250 people it requires each year to serve on ACB's many committees. We put a lot of importance on the committee structure so that leadership is not something that comes from on top, but that comes from the grassroots. Opinions are developed by the membership as a whole, not developed by the leadership and imposed on the membership. Trying to keep that delicate balance between leading and following is what being an ACB president is all about.
Thanks, Brian. Let's talk about leadership style, something very important for an ACB president. And we'll start with you on this one, Brian. I'm sure that all of us on this call have been to leadership seminars or read about leadership, and we all know that there are various leadership styles. How would you answer the question, what kind of a leader are you, Brian?
I think I'm the kind of leader who values the abilities of individuals and values the abilities of our affiliates. It's easy for an individual who's put into a position of leadership to act as if they are, in fact, the most knowledgeable person on the block. I think the mark of a true leader and the mark of my kind of leadership is acknowledging the abilities of others and putting those people to work for the cause we all share, and that is to improve the lives of blind and visually impaired people. My style is not one of going down to the bar and glad-handing with people and playing the politician. I've never been successful at that. Some might consider me to be a little bit distant as a result of not being willing to play that particular game. But if what you want to do is to sit down and talk about what's going to really affect the lives of blind people, what kind of activities we as individuals and collectively can do to improve the lives of blind people, then you've got the right leader and the right leadership style in Brian Charlson.
Chris Gray, what kind of leader are you?
I think it's important to begin the task of leadership from the point of view of humility. We work very hard to assume positions of leadership, and we do that through the exercise of a good bit of ego. There's no way around that, and that's fine. And yet, on the other hand, to be a good leader, to be an effective leader, you have to be more than any other one thing, a good listener, a good communicator, and somebody who is willing not only to share your vision, but listen to the vision of others and incorporate that into the fabric that creates a national organization. I have tried communicating some of my vision. I have four papers out on the website about different aspects of ACB's work, in about sheltered workshops, about transportation, about the Randolph Shepherd vending program, and so on. Communication is what I will do as a leader, and do that in a way that will inspire, I hope, others to be as active and involved in ACB as they possibly can.
Let's talk about communication for a moment, since that's come up now. And I raised this question with the candidates for first vice president, that we were all rank and file members once, and then something happens, leadership talent is recognized, and here you both are now seeking the most senior office in the organization. How will you be able to exercise the many responsibilities of your office that takes so much time, and yet still keep in touch with the grassroots, still be accessible to the rank and file membership who put you there, who will put one of you there in the first place, Chris?
Well, being in touch with the grassroots is critical. If I can't do that as president, I will not have succeeded in certain ways in the office. There are a number of things we could put in place to help this happen. One of these is this debate tonight, to have people hear us on the radio, and if it weren't for Spiderphone, be able to communicate. I would like to create a situation as president of ACB where one officer is available one night a week in a set mechanism to to communicate with the membership of ACB, whether it's an affiliate president or a member of a local chapter. And we need as a board to be more available, more responsive, and I think by creating these kinds of programs, we can do a lot in moving toward that direction.
Brian, your thoughts on communicating, staying in touch with the grassroots?
I think the first thing you'd need to do is to make sure that when you take on the responsibility of president is to make sure that you can free up sufficient time to make those everyday efforts to communicate with the membership. I turned to my family and I asked them, what do you think about me running for president? Is this something that we as a family can support? And I have 100% support of my family in doing that. I turned to my employer and explained to them the responsibilities that were going to be part of this office and asked them, would they be supporting me and the times I'd have to take off from work and spend time on the road working for ACB? And they said, yes, they would be very supportive of that. I think one of the ways that we can best keep in contact with our membership is by getting out to affiliate conventions. Over the course of the past 10 or 15 years, I've visited 25 of our state affiliates, speaking not only as banquet speaker, but as presenter on topics as diverse as old technology and special education and rehabilitation. But most importantly of all, I've spoken about the importance of the ACB family and what it means to work together.
Brian, let's continue with a question about chairmanship. We've talked about leadership, but whoever becomes president is going to be chairing some very significant gatherings, not the least of which, of course, is the supreme governing body of this organization. What are the skills required in a good chairman, and do you have those skills?
Starting with me this time?
Yes, please.
Yes. Well, the first thing, and I think one of the areas that I'd like to see significantly improved is getting out an agenda early, getting out an agenda that really does describe what business is going to be conducted so that everybody comes with ample opportunity to be knowledgeable about the topics that are going to be decided by the board. I also think that getting our committees to put out more regularized written reports of their activities will both encourage them to, in fact, do their work, and also help the board educate themselves prior to getting to the board meetings. I think a great deal of time of boards gets eaten up by hearing reports rather than reacting to and coming up with new ways to forward the issues of the organization. I'd like to see those things changed. To be a chair of any organization means that you need to be willing and insist upon the rights of the minority be heard and respected while allowing the majority view to prevail. I worked hard to do that in ACB, and I think that any chair will attempt to do the same kind of thing.
Could you comment on this question, Chris, of the skills of good chairmanship?
In 1977, I was elected president of the Washington Council of the Blind. And before then, I had had some experience sitting in chairs of local chapters and so on, but that was my first experience actually chairing a whole affiliate. Since that time, I have led three other affiliates, and as first vice president of the California Council of the Blind, found myself on more than one occasion in the position of chairing quite a large organization as we have here in California. Chairmanship is an art based partly on communication, being able to communicate with the person at the microphone and the audience in front of you. It's also a job that requires a significant working knowledge of Robert's Rules of Order, which I have, and believe me, I'm going to be relying on that parliamentarian at ACB to help out when we get into some of those sticky ACB situations. Thank you.
Right on, 1 minute. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the debate between the candidates who have to date declared for the presidency of the American Council of the Blind. We're speaking with Brian Charlson and Chris Gray. And if you were expecting to be able to participate in this debate, we'd love to have had you do that. Unfortunately, there are technical issues that preclude that from happening, and they're out of our control. All we can do is express our regret about that. There is a number of very good high-quality candidates seeking other offices in the American Council of the Blind. And I wonder if you would like to comment, first of all, Chris, on whether there are any particular candidates that you are supporting. In other words, if people are going to vote for you, are there other candidates that they should also be voting for?
There is no candidate running for an ACB office that I couldn't work with, and I've never known a person in official capacity with ACB that I could not work with. I think it's important to begin by saying that. I would urge the membership of ACB in the strongest terms possible to look at each candidate and what their real experiences have been and what their known contributions have been in their work in the organized blind movement. We need people on the board who can move ACB forward to a new level, to a new position in the work that we have to do. We can only do that if we elect people who have a proven track record and real experience in the jobs that they're wishing to do.
Brian, are you endorsing any specific candidates seeking other office?
No, I'm not endorsing any specific candidate. I'd echo what Chris says about the importance of the membership of ACB examining the experience, the skills, and the vision of each candidate for each office. There's a lot of diversity among the candidates for the offices this year in particular. It's not unusual for an organization such as ours to get to convention and find that people are running for positions for which there is no opposition. While I'm not anxious for that situation to be the case, it does put a greater responsibility on the electorate to really examine the skills of these individuals before they cast their votes. We have an incredibly diverse and talented group of people, and it doesn't surprise me that there's a number of people who are going to be well qualified to run for the positions that they're standing for this summer.
Brian, we'll ask you to go first on this question. When we talk about presidency of the U.S., you know, there's often talk about the first 100 days, often people seeking and then gaining office come in with a whole lot of priorities, things they want to get done very quickly. If you become ACB's president, what will some of your first tasks be? What are the things you really want to get on with?
I would say the one dramatic thing I would like to do during those first 100 days is to cause ACB to look inward at its structure and its support of itself. We have some excellent causes that we champion on the state and local and national levels, and international level for that matter. And it's important that we continue to be active on that stage. But not enough effort has been put forth toward strengthening our affiliates. If you've sat in on any of the reports from our credentials committee, you know that some of our affiliates are really struggling to keep things together. Sometimes that's due to financial difficulties. Other times it's due to, a variety of different things, such as the leadership getting worn out and simply stepping aside. I would like to see ACB put some serious effort into developing its own internal capabilities in helping strengthen the affiliates. We are one thing. We are a confederation of affiliates. ACB, though we consider ourselves a national organization, is only as healthy as its affiliate structure. We need to devote more of our time and energies to make sure that that's successful, that each and every one is a healthy organization.
Thanks very much for that, Brian. Chris, your priorities if you were to become the president?
In the first 100 or so days, Jonathan, one of my first tasks would be to convene a committee related to fundraising activities in the organization. I have already made a commitment to the organization to set as a goal the raising of an additional $1 million by the end of 2002. In addition to that, I would set wheels in motion to create a situation to allow us to hold a national summit on transportation. The third thing I would do would be to create a group of people to work directly on the membership difficulties we have in ACB and make that the key issue, or one of the key issues, to be discussed and dealt with at the President's meeting in 2002.
Could you comment, and we'll start with you, Chris, first, about the relationship between the governance arm and the operational arm of ACB and where the dividing lines might be between governance and operational issues?
We've been all over the board on this issue during my time in ACB. We have a situation today which has created some difficulties, I think, in that it's clear that the administrative structure of ACB is far stronger organizationally than the board of directors. It would be one of my goals in my presidency to reassert some of the authority of the board, to do so in a positive way, in a way that does not promote any kind of micromanagement or undue friction between the staff and the elected membership of ACB, but that allows us all to strengthen the organization, working together, working in harmony, but allowing each of these groups to give all that they have to give to the organization.
Brian, the dividing lines between governance and management.
I've had a couple of difficulties with this issue over the course of the past few years. My first concern was that I was seeing way too much of our staff going to state conventions as their speakers and not enough of our elected officials going out to speak on our behalf. I think the electorate have a right to meet the people that have been elected to represent them so that they can bend their ear and help fashion what ACB is going to be in the future. We have some very skilled people in our national office, but each day that they spend on the road at a state convention, we not only lose them in the national office for that day, but they also get comp days for weekend activities, and most of our state conventions happen on weekends. So we lose them for double hours. While I think that there are times when they are the appropriate people to be out there, if you're having difficulty with your newsletter, then Penny Reader ought to be out there helping you with those problems. I do think that we would be better served to get our elected officials out there acting as our spokespersons, listening to the people. I also think that...
I'm sorry, Brian, but if you're going to make another point, I need to stop you because we're just over a minute there. We'll hopefully get back to it. We're listening to debate for candidates for President of the American Council of the Blind. And let me ask you about the convention, though. One of you is going to be chairing next year's convention of the American Council of the Blind. And we'll start with you, Brian. Is there anything you would do differently about the convention, time for more debate or time for more presentations? What would you do with the convention, if anything, differently?
It's interesting. One of the things that our current president has allowed is for officers to chair one day of the convention. And it's quite a different experience being up in the front and having to listen to all those voices down there and figure out who's voted which direction on a voice vote and the like. I do think that it's a delicate balance between having program there that allows people to become educated. You can't ask them to take stands on issues if they haven't been educated about what the pluses and minuses of the different approaches might be. So I would say continuing that balance between program and business, continuing to spread business out throughout the week rather than bunching it all up so that it feels like things get done all on late Friday and early Saturday when so many people have to head back home. I think that really moving that business forward, really making sure that people have an opportunity to access it, things such as the resolutions in a timely fashion allows them to examine the issues in advance. I'd like to work with the Resolutions Committee, with the Bylaws Committee, with the Credentials Committee to make sure those processes are more democratic and allow more opportunity for consideration off the floor so that the debate can be more to the point when on the floor.
Tell us how you would run the convention, Chris.
The membership of ACB is tired of hearing the same thing from the same people every year. We've got to do a number of things to increase the viability and the interest to our membership of the ACB convention program. It is unfortunate, but there's no doubt that one of the ways that we have to do that is to look into paying some speakers. If you want people from Congress to come and speak to you, if you want motivational speakers who can help people know and believe that they can accomplish things, sometimes you have to pay for them. And today, ACB is not necessarily in the position to do that. We have to get in that position. We also, though, have to recognize that our programs have to be strengthened, and we may have to find a very creative way to shorten our convention. I know the membership didn't like it when it was tried before, but the reality seems to be that if we're to contain our costs and make these conventions work logistically, we may have to find a way to chop one day off at the beginning or the end.
That very nicely leads us on to questions about finances, and there are a couple. The first one dealing with the existing cake, and the second one dealing with making the cake larger, as we have done in the last few debates. So, Chris, can we talk about whether you believe that the priorities in terms of resource allocation, financial resource allocation, are appropriate at present, or would you apportion the cake a bit differently?
I don't know if the cake could be apportioned much differently than it is. So much of it involves production of the Braille Forum, staffing requirements, and certain kinds of virtually fixed costs that are very difficult to change. If I could find a way to do so, I would change the current allocation such that we have more emphasis placed on the needs of our individual members of ACB. And I'm very concerned that so many of our members who need legal assistance, who need advice from experts on Social Security and the other very real issues that affect their lives and sometimes impact their lives in some very nasty ways, are things we just aren't dealing with. We've got to deal with the things that are important to our individual members. If we could do that and reapportion the current cake, I would be in favor of that.
Brian, reapportioning the cake, is that possible? Does it need to happen?
I think that you never should get yourself into a situation where there is no, where you lack a means for emphasizing a time-sensitive topic by being able to put a bit of money behind it. There have been times when ACB had to cut back significantly. We've had to furlough staff. We've had to reduce the number of issues at the Braille Forum. And I don't want to ever see us get back to that position again. But if I were to reallocate things at this point, I'd like to find money within the budget for ACB to get on the map when it comes to publishing information. It's amazing how many times our affiliates call our national office and say, we're going to be presenting or exhibiting at a local fair or some activity, and there's very few things that we can provide them in terms of printed literature that talks about the ACB story. We need to find money within our budget to see to it that a good grouping of published articles and brochures and white papers and bibliographies are available to our members that show truly how well-versed and how well-thought-out ACB opinions are.
And, of course, it would be a lot easier if the cake was bigger, and it might not be quite so necessary to concentrate on those reapportioning issues. Brian, do you have any views on what ACB must do in order to generate more revenue for itself?
I would say the first thing that ACB needs to do in this regard is to take the health of its largest fundraising effort, that is ACBES, more seriously. Unfortunately, ACBES has fallen on some tough times, and in fact, every time ACB has had a serious problem with meeting its budgetary obligations, it's been as a result of an unexpected shortfall in the ACBES line item. We need to deal with that, and the first thing we need to do to deal with that is get ACBES to hire the chief executive who has the knowledge of this type of retail business to truly bring it forward. We've had some excellent service over the years from Jim Olson. We've seen his capability, and we know that he can offer a lot to us as CFO, the financial officer. But as of yet, ACBES has yet to hire that executive director. The other thing we can do is to remember that our organization is a combination of all of these affiliates. They need financial support. We need financial support. The only way we're really going to achieve those needs for both sides is for us to work together, coming up with ways that we can have nationally supported and locally conducted fundraising with a sharing of the revenues that they create.
Okay, making the cake bigger, Chris.
I've already said that I believe that ACB should and can increase their treasury by $1 million by the end of 2002. To begin to make that happen, it is my intention, if elected, to convene a committee that will be announced at the post-convention board meeting, composed of some key ACB leaders and key state leaders who have demonstrated in their states the ability to raise significant amounts of money for their organizations. I recently have become a member of the American Association of Professional Fundraisers, and I'm trying to learn a little more in this area from a professional point of view. I am completely convinced that we must reach out from ACB, get a professional grant writer, look into a few grants that I have ideas about, and there are a number of other things that I can think of that we should do externally. I will present a three-pronged program to the board of directors to accomplish the objective of adding $1 million to the ACB budget.
You mentioned affiliates, and that will bring us on to the next question, and that is that there seems to be a perception out there that there needs to be some work on the relationship between the national organization and the affiliates of ACB. We'll ask you first, Chris. Firstly, do you think that's a legitimate perception, and if so, what would you do to remedy that?
Well, I have in the course of the last 4 weeks spoken with most, if not all, of the presidents of ACB affiliates and special interest groups. And it is clear to me, after having had those conversations, that the presidents of many of our affiliates are concerned about the health of the American Council of the Blind. They're concerned that we do more to strengthen the organization and that we do more to take their needs as affiliate presidents and the needs of their affiliates into account at the national level. We've talked a good deal about the accountability of ACB to its affiliates and vice versa. And how we handle that is certainly a balancing act, but it may be that at the moment the balance is not struck quite correctly, certainly not from the point of view of our affiliate leadership.
What's your take on this one, Brian?
Well, as you've heard throughout all of my discussion from my opening remarks to this question, I know that what ACB is about is its affiliates. And they are hurting. A number of them are hurting, whether they have dropped membership or struggling to meet their financial obligations or struggling to keep their members active and involved and more than just paper members. They have needs, and ACB needs to take some of its time, some of its resources, and a considerable amount of its enthusiasm and turn it inwards to help them develop all of the infrastructure that's necessary for an organization like ours, as diverse as ours, to thrive. I think, in fact, that if there's one criticism that can be leveled at the national organization as opposed to its individual affiliates, is that we're spending so much time looking outside of ourselves at what other people are doing that we've forgotten to take care of our own, and we need to return to those basic core concepts.
I'd like to tease that one out a little bit further, and we'll ask this of Brian first, relating specifically to what specific steps ACB at a national level can take to increase the number of members that ACB has, Brian.
I mentioned a moment ago how important I think it is that we develop some literature that can really speak the ACB story. And some of that literature should be directed at specific populations that haven't chosen to join with ACB, perhaps believing that we don't care or understand about their needs. We should be putting out some information about what it's like to be a blind person with diabetes. There are tens of thousands of blind people out there who that's the core of their personal issues, their personal health as a result of diabetes. We need to be seen to be players in that regard, and you can only do that by publishing. We can do similar things in terms of dealing with issues of other subgroups, such as those who are older and blind, who for some reason this country has turned its back on because it doesn't fit the traditional rehabilitation model. More than 50% of our blind population in the United States are elders, and yet very, very few services are actually rendered to them. We need to become players there. If we're seen as players, we'll draw those people into our organization, and they can only add to our health.
And, Chris, what specific steps can ACB take to increase its membership at a national level?
The first step ACB should take is to reinstitute the ACB leadership seminars that were held more consistently in past times. Going into a region of the country, especially a region where we do not have strength in numbers, and presenting information, providing a forum for people to come and talk with each other and to talk with us, is a key way of increasing our membership. If we could find the resources to hire someone who spent their full time going around the country dealing with membership issues, that would be a wonderful thing for ACB to do. In addition, I talked about getting grants earlier, and one grant that I would go after right away would be a grant to get a person on board who could spend full time doing nothing but information and referral for ACB. We would attract so many people calling us in need of information, and then we would know who they are and where they are, and that in and of itself would allow us to create new opportunities for our local affiliates and probably create local affiliates where we have none today.
Okay, thank you for that. You're both professionals in the technology arena, and I wonder if you'd like to comment on where ACB's internet initiatives will be heading under your presidency, so when one of you is president. Chris, would you go first?
Yeah, there's a lot of things I could say about technology, but you did ask about ACB's internet. So let me say that I think we're in a very strong position today in our internet presence. We have the ACBL, the leadership list, the board list. ACB maintains a number of other lists for friendly organizations that the membership may not be aware of, but it is something we do. We have a great website, and et cetera, et cetera, and ACB Radio, of course. But the future is something we have to look toward very carefully. For one thing, we need to bring more of the internet business under our own control. And much more importantly than that, we need to be able to bring the internet to those of our members who do not today have internet access. I have a plan for doing that. I have a prototype that would allow us to bring our internet presence to anybody in ACB that has a touchtone telephone.
Okay, thanks for that. And we will come back and talk about issues, by the way, relating to externalities. So we are going to move on to that section. Brian, ACB's internet strategy, if you were to be president, where would it be heading?
I think the number one thing we have to remember is that while we're embracing internet, the vast majority of our membership, the vast majority of blind people do not have access to the internet. And we need to find a way and to work together to see to it that our brothers and sisters in ACB have an opportunity to gain all the access to the information that we so easily reach through things like ACB Radio and our lists. There are technologies, as Chris mentioned before, where you can simply use your touchtone phone to access much of this information, and we need to see to it that gets done. I also think that it's a matter of education. I work in the field of training blind and visually impaired people to use technology. And I've put my money where my mouth is. I've gone out and sought the necessary resources to offer at each ACB convention a training room where my agency, the Carroll Center for the Blind, donates the services of two of its trainers to come out and train ACB people in how best to use their computer systems. Last year, we put together the SoundForge training seminar, for example, Jonathan, trying to get out there and develop those who have the skills and desires to produce programming for ACB Radio. We need to continue to do that, develop our members' abilities to add content to our internet, and also not forget the vast majority who struggle each day to get any information, let alone having access to the computer and
okay.
the training to learn to use that computer.
This is great. You know, what happens is that both of you are coming up with very, very, very long sentences just on the one-minute mark, so it's very clever. Let me just continue, though, and ask you about some issue questions. And I think by way of continuity, we'll go on and talk about access. And in the first instance, technological access. What are some of the priorities in terms of access to not just computer technology, but technology of all kinds? And how does ACB make a difference in this area, Brian?
I think the way that ACB has and continues to make an impact on this is not necessarily with our own dollars and exclusively our own resources. As I mentioned from the outset here, I'm here with the American Foundation for the Blind, one of the partners with which ACB has worked extremely well over the years. They have, in this year alone, put $1 million into developing a model website that meets all of the most extreme accessibility standards put together by the World Wide Web Consortium. We need to partner with them, and we have partnered with them in the past, but we need to continue that partnership to assure that all of those different organizations, at this point, government organizations through 508 will have to make their websites accessible. We need to be involved in that process. We are involved in that process through the chair of our Information Access Committee, Debbie Cook, and through a number of other different organizations that we give input to. We need to continue doing that because the Internet is such a growing, changing, live creature that trying to pin it down to accessibility standards is something, quite honestly, we cannot afford. We will never be able to afford to run that all by ourselves.
Access to technology. Chris Gray, your thoughts on this?
It is my my belief, and I've made no secret of it for a long time, that I think ACB has made a complete mess of many issues related to access and access technology. We need to be much stronger with regard to our position regarding Windows access and issues related to Microsoft. We face, as blind people, every day lack of access when we go to use PDF files, despite the progress we have made, when we have to deal with animations on websites that block our entry. We are not further ahead today than we were 5 years ago. And while many individuals have done phenomenal work, Brian mentions Debbie, for example, and I totally agree, it is equally true that the Access Committee as a committee has not functioned as a committee, and we have to do something about that. It's important that we deal with the access issues. They go to the core of our ability to work and to compete as blind people, and I think we have to do better and we have to do more.
What about access to appliances? In both of your answers, you're focused on access to computers, and obviously that's important. There are people who are unable to use the most basic of household appliances that we once could use, such as stereo systems and televisions and VCRs, and of course cell phones have come along and they can be a problem. What practical difference can ACB actually make in this area, and how does it go about doing that, Chris?
We do have big problems. I mean, I imagine most people who are listening tonight have cell phones, and getting your cell phone to work is an exercise in frustration sometimes, changing the ring or doing anything like that. But we really have to choose maybe two or three key companies that we learn through experience will work with us, can work with us, and try and create some real accessible equipment. The only way to lead in this area is through example. And we haven't created those examples. We haven't made the contacts we need to make yet. I hope that we can. And I would certainly devote a great deal of energy toward making that happen as president of ACB.
What do we do about appliance access, Brian?
We start at the beginning. We're going to be meeting in Des Moines, Iowa. Iowa, in fact, the Des Moines area, happens to be the location of a major manufacturer of household appliances. And we need to be working with them while we're in Des Moines to make sure that they understand the nature of our issues, that we are very concerned that the day may come when blind people need personal care attendance, not because they don't have the ability to use appliances, but because those appliances have changed in such a way that they can't independently use them. I think back on the story of Janice Peterson, who came home one day finding out that her apartment complex had graciously put new stoves in everybody's apartments. And when she went to set the temperature on her stove, she found that she had to hold her finger down on a button, and it rotated all the way around the numbers. You were supposed to stop pushing it when it came to the degrees you wanted to cook at. Made it impossible for her to cook her dinner that evening. We need to make this a core issue of ACB's information access. When I assisted in pulling together people to serve on that committee, I selected people specifically because they voiced interest in that area. I, as Chris, I'm disappointed that that committee has not been more functional over time.
Okay, I've got to stop you there. Let's talk about another form of access, and this is access to public transport, something that has come up in questions, comments on ACBL, all over the place, public transport. What does ACB do to make a difference in this area, Brian?
There are funds available, as ACB has said on a number of occasions, and through our pedestrian safety handbook. There are monies out there, federal monies, that local municipalities can utilize to bolster the accessibility of their communities. It's first we need to make sure that blind and visually impaired people can get to public transportation or to paratransit in a safe environment. ACB's made a commitment to do that. We've put our money where our mouth is when it comes to advocating for that kind of a safe environment. Secondly, we need to make sure that, especially now with gas prices going up, there's going to be more and more emphasis on public transportation as a way to reduce our energy dependence on oil. We need to be players as that continues to develop to make sure that we as blind people have access to that transportation. But transportation is only accessible, especially fixed transportation, if we can get the announcements of the stops so that you don't end up getting on the bus only to find out that the bus driver forgot your stop and didn't let you off and you're a mile down the road.
And that's where I have to stop you, Ryan. Let's talk about public transportation, Chris.
Well, I'm very fortunate, and it's by no accident that I live in San Francisco, one of the greatest transportation meccas in the country. And Brian may feel the same way. He lives in Boston, which is another great transportation mecca. We are very fortunate, as are other ACB members who live in places like Seattle, New York City, cities that are known for their great transportation infrastructure. The reality is that most of the country has no such infrastructure. The transportation systems in our country are literally falling apart around our ears. Bus companies are going out of business. It's not untypical for people, even in major cities, to have their entire transportation system shut down by 6 p.m. in the evening. We in ACB today do not have a comprehensive transportation policy or a real answer to this question, and it's my belief that one of the most important things that I would do as president in my first 6 months would be to convene a transportation summit to try and come to an expression of this policy for transportation, paratransit, infrastructure, and seek a national and state solutions for this terrible problem.
No matter what we do, we don't seem to be able to make any kind of dent in the high unemployment statistics, that's if you believe the statistics. What can ACB practically do to try and make that elusive dent in the unemployment statistics, Chris?
Well, the unemployment issue is a big, big issue. It would be one of my three major external issues I would focus on. We have to look at it in a number of ways. First of all, I think that we need to be very sure that our Social Security and disability insurance systems do not create disincentives to employment, and that certainly isn't entirely the case today. We also have to look at the categorical specialized services for the blind and the rehabilitation system. We know, as blind people, that our rehabilitation system in the United States is not working. It hasn't ever worked very well. Considering it's a system that's supposed to help blind people, it's one of the most unpopular systems that we know of. And I don't have all the answers for rehabilitation reform, but there are answers out there, and we have to come to some consensus within ACB about what those answers ought to be.
Thanks very much, Chris. The unemployment statistics, Brian, what can ACB practically do about them?
I think what we need to do is to remember that what makes the difference between an employable blind person and a not employable blind person is partly the education that they bring as potential employees. We seem to be able to get people the necessary educations. We can buy their way into colleges and universities. They can then prove themselves and earn their way through getting those degrees. But what they frequently don't come to the table with when going out and looking for work is any former work experience. We need to put together a system by which we can assist our fellow brothers and sisters who are blind and visually impaired out there to get some work experience. We need to remind one another that not all jobs do you start at the top of the heap. I helped can sauerkraut and green beans and built kidney dialysis machines and swept floors in order to raise the money necessary to put myself through college. That gave me the work experience on my resume that when I went looking for work, it was a non-issue. We need to give other people the opportunities to make that of their lives. That's how we can control our own destinies.
Okay, thank you for that. When you've got a job, and assuming you can get the bus or the train or the subway somewhere to get to that job, then there's a question, of course, of crossing streets, pedestrian access. This is something that ACB has already done a lot of work on. What would you do to continue to advance this cause of accessible pedestrian signaling, Brian?
I think that there's a number of interesting projects going on around our country that can help us better promote the general availability of audible traffic signals and reasonable design of curb cuts. With respect to audible traffic signals, I was down speaking before the Florida Council convention a couple of weeks ago, and they brought on to their program a gentleman who's responsible for the State Department of Transportation. And he brought with him a wonderful example of how one can prioritize when and under what circumstances one would put an audible traffic signal in. We need that kind of nuts and bolts kind of documents for our members to take to their communities as they advocate for accessible traffic signals. When it comes to the curb cut issue, which is a major, major problem for people in their mobility, whether they're cane users or guide dog users, we need to insist that as those curb cuts go in, that the standards laid out in the Access Board standards that call for detectable warnings in those curb cuts are dealt with to the letter, as the regulations require.
Chris, could you talk to us about pedestrian access?
Yes, we've been waiting for a long time for the updates to ADAG standards that might help us in some sense in that. And I have to say, I'm very sensitive about this issue. I happen to work on an intersection where in the last 9 months, three people, none of them blind, I'm happy to say, have been killed. Pedestrian safety is not just an issue that relates to blind people. It relates to anybody who is brave enough to take their 2 feet and walk across the street. Part of what we must do, I think, is work on the alliances between the blind community and external communities try and put some synergy between those groups to work to help on these issues. It's unfortunate that they're local in nature for the most part, and this makes it more difficult, but that would be one thing I would encourage very much.
Chris, President Bush has made it clear that there is going to be significant Social Security reform if he's able to get that through. Your thoughts on Social Security and what ACB needs to be doing in the next couple of years about that issue?
Yes. I mentioned earlier about my papers on the website, and I have a paper called Social Security, Working Our Way Through the Morass, and often that's what Social Security is. for blind people. It's a huge, complex structure of regulations which no one individual is easily capable of coming to grips with. The most important thing we have to focus on in Social Security, whether it be the SSI program or the disability insurance program, is the removal of disincentives to work. When we leave that issue, we have to think about the relationship of it to Medicare coverage and the availability of prescription drugs for blind people. And like it or not, as blind people, we're going to have to face up to the issue that if we want to find significantly more financial resources for computer equipment, for braille displays, for white canes, whatever we need, that money probably exists more readily in the Social Security, Medicare area than anywhere else.
Brian, could you give us some thoughts on Social Security and where ACB should be heading in that area in the next couple of years?
I remember the frustrations that I had with the Social Security Administration when I was an SSI recipient and when my wife was an SSI and SSDI recipient. The amount of paperwork that a blind or visually impaired person is expected to generate in support of their right to receive SSI and SSDI is incredible. Although we do have to continue to work on issues that Chris outlined, the disincentives such as the loss of medical funding. You know, you have to decide, can I dare take this beginner job that doesn't come with insurance? If I do, I'm going to lose my insurance and I'm on dialysis. How am I possibly going to do that? We certainly have to make that a core value. But for all of those out there who are receiving it today, getting another letter from the Social Security Administration in non-accessible form is more than a frustration. It leaves us occasionally with incredibly huge overpayments, all as a result of not getting any information from that administration in accessible form. Those who have been monitoring the ACBL list know that this is a going concern, a real issue among our membership, and we need to take aggressive steps to insisting that administration communicate with us in a way that's effective.
Thanks, Brian. Let's talk about electoral reform in a federal context. Since the presidential election last year, there's been a lot of noise and indeed some progress, I guess, to do with election reform and particularly the way that people cast their votes. To what extent do you believe this is a priority for the next couple of years, Brian, and what can ACB do to influence a positive outcome in a more accessible voting environment for blind people?
I mentioned earlier that we need to find flexibility within our budget structure to hit certain issues when the iron is hot, and this is such an issue. While it may not be the most important thing to a person who's unemployed to say, well, we're going to put some real effort into giving you freedom to go and cast your ballot and to do it in privacy. Nonetheless, the time is right for us to have an impact on this in virtually every municipality around the country. Unfortunately, it is being done and has to be done by the nature of our laws and regulations on a municipality-by-municipality basis. Again, while down at the Florida Convention, you can imagine, with Florida being in the center of this controversy, we got to hear from a number of different manufacturers of accessible voting machine technology. I would propose that the time has come for us to put together a seminar specifically on the subject of voter access, whether it be to register to vote, to use that voting machine independently, to advocate that your community acquire reasonable voting technology. I think the time has come for ACB to take that bull by the horns and see what we can do to assure that our membership are going to be educated and well-spoken when it comes to going to their municipalities and insisting on their rights to cast the secret ballot.
You have a comment on accessible voting, Chris?
Yes, I'm in favor of accessible voting, of course, and am very mindful of how difficult it can be. At the polls this year, I had the most unfortunate experience of having to cast a ballot with the assistance of someone who wasn't really very cooperative about a blind person casting a ballot, period. And I would love to be able to vote in private and in secret in certain situations. And I think this is a right that blind people need and certainly want. We've had great progress, apparently, in this regard in Florida. according to notes on ACB, LACB leadership. You know, 2 years ago at the Washington Council of the Blind Convention, they had a demonstration of accessible voting machines. The issue is not accessibility of the machines. It's selling the right machine to our state governments. And I think that's where the focus has to be in that area.
I'd like to ask you about audio description now. And I feel a bit guilty that we're only going to give you a minute to answer the question. But the first is the degree to which this is a priority. Some callers have phoned into Blindline, and I've seen comments on email lists that suggests that, you know, sure, it would be nice to have audio description, but that ACB is spending far too much time and potentially money through the courts, I guess, on this. Could you tell us, Chris, what you think of audio description in terms of its priority compared with other issues, and what kind of outcome would you be seeking as president?
Yes. The issue of the priority of audio description is primarily a manufactured issue which has been raised by the National Federation of the Blind to cover their tracks in their activities opposing audio description. The reality is that ACB many years ago gave WGBH a major award for creating the idea of audio-described films. These films are readily available, and there was a major success in beginning to move that kind of description into the television environment. For whatever reason, some blind people have sought to oppose that and have actually sought to jeopardize the ability of the FCC to make rules that help disabled people. That's the real issue, and we have to do everything we can to fight that issue, get it resolved on behalf of blind people.
What are your thoughts on this one, Brian?
I've been involved in the whole DVS question from way back when, because I happened to live in Boston, the home of WGBH. So it was my privilege to be involved in the early design efforts of that service. It is more than just access to entertainment. It's access to American culture. Television, yes, it is a form of entertainment. There's no doubt about that. But it's also at the core of much of our culture. And we need to have access to that the way that we need to have access to museums and other cultural activities in our community. I don't think it's a misplaced priority. I think, among other things, as Chris said, it's also a matter of whether or not we believe that the FCC has a right, whether, in fact, a federal body has the right to impose on companies who seek licensure from our government to provide a service. Exclusive licensure, I might add, that we have a right to expect that with the granting of that privilege should come the responsibility to see to it that all the citizens benefit from that experience. If we back down on this issue, we will have to back down on a number of other issues where we think that perhaps the federal government ought not to be involved in imposing. I think it's a matter of imposing an unreasonable mandate. I think it's a matter of insisting on equal access.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's talk about the Randolph Shepard program, because it seems that this program is increasingly coming under some pretty fierce attacks. Firstly, does the program stand up to scrutiny? Can it be defended in the 21st century? And if so, what will ACB do to defend it, Brian?
I think it can be defended in this century for a number of different reasons. What is indefensible is 70% unemployment. Whether you believe that statistic to be 100% accurate, and I think that there's some cause to think that it's a rather inflated number, I'm confident that nonetheless blind and visually impaired people unfortunately experience an unemployment rate 10 times higher or better than non-blind persons. So we need to find a way to level the playing field. One of the ways that we've been successful in doing that is the Randolph Shepard Vending Program. There are those out there who may think of the Randolph Shepard Vending Program as just kind of another kind of sheltered employment. It is not.
I used to run a vending stand program, a vending stand at the State Agriculture Building in Oregon, and I've never worked harder in my life than I did as a vendor. You get paid last. You have to work long, hard hours. You have to work within the system for a number of years before you really get to any kind of financial benefit that's similar to the amount of effort that you're putting into it. Very much like regular business, because in fact, ladies and gentlemen, it is a regular business.
All right, I just have to stop you there. Chris, your thoughts on this program, and firstly, whether it can be defended, and if so, what ACB should do to defend it.
The Randolph Shepherd Vending Program is the single most successful federally mandated program for creating jobs for any disability group we've ever had in this country. And Randolph Shepherd vendors are business people. They're hard workers, and they know a good deal about selling and about business that I would like to see them lend to ACB in terms of expertise, and fully intend to go and talk to RSVA about that. We do have to recognize that the program was created in the mid-1930s in an environment significantly different than today. And the realities that vendors face today are very difficult and very trying for them. We have to seek greater autonomy for vendors, especially those who want it. We have to seek new and better means of placing stands and avoiding the threat placed on them by the fast food manufacturers. But it is viable, it can work, and I believe in doing everything we can do to strengthen the program in the years to come.
Thanks for that. Let's take a look at some relationship issues now. One of you is likely to be the president at the end of this process and will probably be dealing with the president of the National Federation of the Blind from time to time. I know, as mentioned in the previous debate, that President Edwards has expressed some regret about the turn, the climate of the dialogue that has exhibited itself in the last little while. Could you comment first, Chris, on the nature of the relationship with the National Federation of the Blind if you were president? It seems that there is a feeling that if the two organizations are seen publicly to be at loggerheads, that all the blind suffer as a result.
Clearly, the relationship between ACB and NFB is very troublesome today. I think it may well be that we are at least in part suffering the difficulties that we suffer now because ACB has allowed itself to be considered weaker than need be to the NFB. I'm not in favor of fighting with any organization. I'm not also willing to walk away when blind people are being damaged, which is certainly the case in the video description affair. We must be strong in ACB for who we are, the things we believe, and the things we want for blind people. If we can do that and the NFB can agree with us, that's fine. We work with them here in California. When we can't, then we need to go our own way, do our own thing, and in that sense, the NFB is basically irrelevant.
What's your view on this, Brian?
I think the American Council of the Blind has bent over backwards to try to keep a reasonably professional relationship with the National Federation of the Blind over the past 6 years while I've been first vice president and Paul Edwards has been president. It has not been an easy thing to attempt. We each time tried to make it clear that when we disagreed, we were disagreeing on issues, that we acknowledge the right of NFB to be NFB, and they ought to acknowledge the right of ACB people to be ACB people. But we find ourselves in conflict today, and we find ourselves in conflict over a couple of basic issues. ACB took a stand, worked hard, was successful in getting the audio description component put into the FAA regulations, or rather the FCC regulations. We need not to back down on that. And if NFB wants to challenge our efforts, then we need to be ready to stand up and challenge right back. We also took a stand on some financial issues that NFB found insulting. Those financial issues were using federal money federal money to support Newsline. It has nothing to do with whether Newsline is a good service or not. It was that that federal money was tagged for Newsline and Newsline alone, turning its back on programs such as that in Washington, D.C. and in the state of Kansas that use local volunteers to narrate with human voices the newspapers.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's talk about, I'll ask another question in this line. If somebody came up to you as president of the American Council of the Blind and said, what is it about ACB that makes it special? Why should I join ACB instead of another blindness consumer organization? What would your response be, Brian?
I was asked that question just earlier today. And the answer, I think, is quite simple. ACB honors the individual. If you want to be part of an organization that honors your thoughts, your beliefs, and is interested in incorporating those thoughts and beliefs into our organization, this is, we have the infrastructure, we have the culture that supports that. We believe in the value of diversity, and we also believe in the value of democracy. Not democracy that says once you've elected an official that they are your spokesperson and you should bow down to what they say. Not that type of democracy, but a dynamic democracy where you can disagree with your leadership without fear of reprisal, where you can modify the organization's belief, even if it isn't the belief that the leadership has. If it's the belief that the membership has, you have every right to promote it, and you have every right to succeed and insist that the leadership follow those beliefs. That's what ACB is all about, and if you're interested in that kind of an organization, we'd love to have you as a member.
Chris, what makes ACB, in your mind, the preferred organization?
Many of the founders of ACB came from the southern part of the United States and had a very southern way of looking at this country. They were very much involved in the belief in states' rights and very opposed to the idea of things being dictated from on high, if you will. And ACB today owes, in many ways, its structure to that more populist notion, to that more diverse way of organizing people and making things happen. We believe in ACB that our strength comes from every individual member, and that is entirely the opposite of the way that NFB runs itself. You have to make a clear decision about which way you want to go, and many people are impressed by what can be done quickly in a top-down structured organization. And the most effective and capable of those people usually wind up in ACB.
All right. Let me just ask you a bit further about that, because there are some people who say that ACB is so democratic that sometimes it's unable to respond in a timely manner to issues as they arise. Now, both of you must have given this considerable thoughts as individuals who want to seek the office of president. How will you deal with that balancing act between the very important principles, the foundations of the organization, in fact, of democracy, and decisive leadership, which is often required, Chris?
It is a balancing act. You're quite right to characterize it that way. The thing to keep in mind is that every year, the convention, as the supreme authority of ACB, puts in motion a set of overall priorities. And if the convention is given the correct information and if leadership is working adequately, the convention will provide the overall instruction that the board of directors and the staff of the organization need to be able to function and make those more immediate decisions. We have that possibility, and I think that if you can just look back to your resolutions and to your motions on the floor, that in most cases we can function as much as we're willing to take a risk as a board and as staff.
Brian, your thoughts on this one?
I have a bookcase in my den at home, And one of the shelves is dedicated to hard copy ACB documents. And the largest proportion of those are ACB resolutions. They are the core structure of our organization. They outline the policies. We also have designed within the ACB Constitution a chain of authority for when actions have to be taken. Between conventions, action can be taken by the board of directors. And between board meetings, action can be taken by the president. But in both of those cases, those actions cannot be contrary to resolutions passed by the membership at the National Convention. A president can make decisive action, take decisive actions based on non-conflict with those resolutions and with the understanding that there is an executive committee to advise him, there is a board he can turn to if time permits, and all of those are there to make sure that whatever action is taken is a true ACB action, not the action of an individual.
People will be looking to one of you to be the primary champion for the issues that ACB has determined through the convention, the supreme governing body. I wonder how you would deal with a situation where a decision was taken by the convention that you totally oppose with every core of your being, something that just absolutely went against everything that you stand for. What would you do in that eventuality, Brian?
If it's an issue, well, let me back up here. I think everybody has a right to a personal opinion, and you have a right to debate your personal opinion. But when you're an officer in ACB, and you've had an opportunity to speak your mind, and others have had an opportunity to speak their mind, and a group decision has been made, you, because you've agreed to accept the mantle of leadership, have to take your personal opinions and set them aside. You are a spokesperson from that point forward, whether speaking in your capacity as an elected official, and there are those out there who have made statements saying, now I'm not speaking as a member of the board, or I'm not speaking as an officer, I'm only speaking as me. I don't think you can ever say you're only speaking as you. Once that decision has been made by the membership, I think you as their elected person, the person they've chose to lead them, but also to speak for them, to speak the party line when it comes to that kind of activity. It's one of the things that you must accept when you accept leadership.
What are your thoughts, Chris?
Well, if you'll forgive a moment of levity, what I could do, I suppose, if I really hated the idea a lot, I'd create a committee of 20 people, give them the task, and it would never get done. No, but seriously, what I would do in a case like that, I mean, I think what Brian is saying is correct. If the membership actually passes a resolution or requests something be done, then whether I like it or not is not very important. The thing to do would be to find a person who champions that idea, who was a key person in getting the idea passed, and let them run with it. They wanted it, they convinced the organization, and they ought to have the opportunity to make it be the best idea that it can be.
That's an interesting question, or an interesting comment that takes us to my next question, which is the way in which ACB can involve all of those who are keen to be involved at a national level. And I suppose that may not be possible in practice, but does ACB do a good enough job at including everyone who has lots of enthusiasm and time that they're willing to donate to the organization, Chris?
We certainly have a committee structure that contains a number of people, number of names and addresses, and a lot of those people are very active and very committed. The most you hear from people, of course, is at conventions, and people do get excited at conventions and have the best of intentions and sometimes just aren't able to carry those out afterwards. And we understand that too. I think that the thing we have to do is use our affiliates and use leadership training seminars to identify the people that have potential, the people that want to work for ACB. And we need to mentor those people, strengthen them, help them understand the organization, and bring them along as members of the organization who can be our future leaders. It starts with students. It starts with people who are new to the organization. If we take that kind of approach to our membership, we will always find and use the best people.
Thank you very much for that. What are your thoughts on this, Brian?
I think there's a couple of things that we can do to make sure that individuals who are selected to serve on committees feel that their time and energies are appreciated. I think that's a serious problem whenever a committee gets too huge. Christian mentioned a moment ago that if you really want to kill an issue, just appoint a 20-person committee to it. Nothing ever gets done. I think that in many cases, we've allowed some of our committees to get too large in an effort to try to include everybody who showed any interest on any topic, even remotely associated with committee, to put them on it. I would suggest that what we really need to do is have more smaller, time-specific, issue-specific task forces that don't become codified in regulations and constitutional amendments. Chris mentioned transportation. Transportation is an ongoing issue, and we need to certainly put together some people to work on the subject of transportation. But if we were to put every ACB person who had something to contribute to that issue on a single committee and dub it transportation, we're going to have a committee of 20-plus. What we really need to do is have several task forces working on smaller topics like paratransit and fixed route services, those kinds of split-down issues with time-specific goals where we can really get some work done on a really time-sensitive, fast-hitting manner.
Thank you very much. Let's take a look at the question of cross-disability organizations, cooperations, coalitions, and whether you support ACB being involved in such inter-disability organizations. What are your thoughts on this, Brian?
It's a delicate walk that we have to do in dealing with coalitions. There are some excellent organizations out there that represent people that have common interest to us on a single issue. Chris mentioned earlier all of those pedestrians out there who are just as much in jeopardy as we are when putting a foot off the curb and into the roadway. And we do need to make coalition with those individuals as our needs converge. We also, however, have to be very careful when we get involved with cross-disability coalitions, and ACB has, I think, done a very effective job in this respect. We believe in categorical services, that is, specialized services that meet the specific needs of blind and visually impaired people as people with disabilities. We can never take those issues and make them less important in an effort to try to make ourselves acceptable in a coalition. But for the most part, we haven't been asked to do that. We do occasionally find ourselves in issues where this is going to be difficult. I understand that 2 days ago, President Bush pronounced Joanne Wilson, the NFB director of the Louisiana Center for the Blind, as his nominee for RSA, Rehabilitation Services Administration director.
Yes, I'm just going to have to stop you there. Chris, your thoughts on this issue?
The greatest single coalition that has helped blind people was the inclusion of all people who had difficulty reading in the Library of Congress Talking Book and Braille Book Program. It infused a huge amount of capital into the program, and we have so much more to read and so much more quality material to read today that it's just unbelievable. If we could find other areas where the coalescing of disability groups was as successful, it would sure be a wonderful world. ADA was another example where coalition was a great success. And while it may not have been as helpful to blind people as some would like, there's no question that it has been a huge help. We have to work and think about those areas that have made us strong. And yet, on the other hand, when other disability groups wish to take things away from blind people, that we have worked so hard to get. We must stand up and say to them, we'll help you get things that make you equal to us. We will not give up anything that we have to bring us down to a different level.
After the first couple of debates, I had an email from someone who was concerned about the profile that ACB has in the wider media and asked me to talk to the candidates about this. And I did think it was a very good question. Is it important to both of you, the profile that ACB has? And if it is, what can be done so that if there's a blindness issue that comes up, that the media outlets immediately think, we'll go and ask ACB what they think of this, Chris?
Media certainly is important. And we saw the media used in some rather bizarre ways with regard to the AOL suit, with regard to the nonsense around the Mr. Magoo movie. We need to work very hard in ACB to approach responsible journalists and try and create some responsible media that helps blind people. ACB will inevitably be a part of that and be mentioned, and in that sense, we'll be helping ACB at the same time. To just go after the media and try and write some nice stories about ACB is probably not going to be very successful because it's just too self-serving. But if you think about the excellent Wall Street Journal article earlier this year, actually there were two. One was more controversial than the other, I guess, but I think they were both ultimately good for blind people because they cast blind people in a good light.
Thanks very much for that. And Brian, your thoughts on ACB's media profile?
I think ACB does have to be somewhat concerned about its media profile. I'm not sure how much of our resources we should dedicate to trying to get the name ACB to be a household word in America. There are places one can publish one's address and information so that the media knows that when they want to get an opinion about a subject that is associated with blindness, that they can just bring up their list of names and addresses and pull us out of that particular hat. And in fact, that has happened on more than one occasion. I think back on the NPR story that our executive director, Charlie Crawford, was asked to participate in. We do get called on those cases. Do we get as called as often as the National Federation of the Blind? No, we don't. It takes serious capital to play that particular game. I'm more concerned that when we do speak, when we are quoted, when we are asked our opinions, that we're the ones who come across sounding like we are well educated about the topic we're speaking about. We're not doing sensationalism type of journalism. We're not involved in a lot of expenditure of money to get a moment splash in the media.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll stop you there. We're going to round this debate off in just a second. I think that we've given both of you a reasonable grilling, as is befitting of the office that you seek. And we will invite... yes, let me just go back. Yes, we had Brian going first, so we'll invite Chris to make his opening statement first of 2 minutes, if you will, Chris.
Okay. I may not even take 2 minutes because I want to just leave you with a few key thoughts. I want to offer ACB my energy, my commitment, and my strengths that are related to administration and to task management. I want to assure the membership of ACB that I'm mindful of and thinking about the tasks that a president must perform, a new president, such as appointing members of the Board of Publications, key committee appointments, and the appointments I mentioned earlier tonight regarding fundraising. I believe I can offer a great skill of leadership and inclusion to ACB, and something I offer which I think is unique is a vision of where ACB needs to go. The vision is coming out of where we've been in our past and where we are today. And I think we're really at a point now where we're on a threshold of a new and exciting future. We have the ability to bring new funding into the organization. We have key issues that need to be worked on, especially in this Bush administration. And I ask for your support and your help in becoming president of the American Council of the Blind, and look forward to bringing this new vision and a bright and enriched future to ACB. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. And Brian, your closing statement.
All of you, like me, are concerned about the future of the American Council of the Blind. It's the right thing to be, always concerned about it. But don't for one moment doubt that what the ACB is today is something to be proud of. I'm very proud that I've had the opportunity to serve on ACB's board in a variety of different capacities, on committees in a variety of capacities, because it's allowed me to bring to ACB my strengths. People talk about finding a home, and certainly ACB is my home. But I didn't just find this home, I helped make this home. I worked with leaders under the presidency of Grant Mack and Leroy Saunders and Paul Edwards and Otis Stevens to see to it that ACB was part of the 21st, of the year 2001. We need to work together. We need to admire the abilities of one another. I certainly do admire Chris. I remember I worked on his campaign when he first ran for the ACB board. I respect him. I believe that we also owe a debt of gratitude to the current crop of leaders that have been running ACB individually and collectively and with the support and listening to our membership. Now is the time for you to decide whether you think the last 6 years allowed ACB to grow under the leadership of Paul Edwards and with the support of Brian Charleston. If what you've seen in the last 6 years you are proud of, if you like the successes you've seen, then I'd ask you that you support me for the office of president. I'd like to continue to do that. If I'm not selected to do that, I cannot begin to express the gratitude I have to ACB for all of the years that they've allowed me to serve them in this capacity, and I hope they'll call upon me again in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. That was exactly 2 minutes, and that's where we conclude the debate. So I'd like to thank you both for giving up so much of your time, and you guys are going to be real busy in Des Moines and caucusing and meeting people and shaking hands. Are you going to be kissing any babies?
I don't know that many of our members are bringing babies, but I do understand there's a group there called, what was it, Yakety Yak?
Yeah, don't talk back.
Have a daycare center kind of scenario set up. So, I don't know about you, Chris, but I think I might go down there and see what's happening.
Well, you know, we might learn something.
Yeah.
You never know. That's where our youngest members are going to come from.
Hey, you guys, thank you so much. We'll look forward to seeing you both in Des Moines, and I really appreciate you giving up so much of your time this evening.
You too, Jonathan.
Okay.
Thank you, Jonathan, for your great job.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
That was Chris Gray and Brian Charleston seeking the office of President of the American Council of the Blind. And so now, the decision is entirely yours. Those of you who will be attending the ACB convention in Des Moines will be having your say on the Friday of convention week. And of course, those of you who are not can still make your voice heard by talking to those people in your affiliates. It has been an honor to be given the opportunity to do these debates and talk to such dedicated and committed individuals. ACB is certainly a very, very lucky organization. My apologies once again that the technology didn't quite see us through. I'm reminded of the story of Sparky and the magic piano. Old kid's story. I think it came from America, so you probably know it. Sparky runs his fingers along the keys and the piano plays itself and he goes on this concert tour. But then the piano gets fed up and decides it won't play anymore. Well, it was a bit like that for us this evening. The next time you hear from me will be in Des Moines. Look forward to seeing many of you there, and thank you.
As well as ACB Radio Mainstream,
The Cafe,
ACB Radio Treasure Trove,
you can hear
live, unpredictable internet
on the ACB Radio Interactive.
ACB Radio Interactive,
playing music from
the 1930s and 40s,
the 50s and 60s,
the 1970s,
80s and 90s,
the hits of the new millennium.
ACB Radio Interactive comes to you from at least 6 time zones on 3 continents, bringing you the very best of
country,
top 40,
classic and modern rock,
new age,
folk,
the rare stuff out of the 50s,
jazz,
easy listening adult contemporary,
and more.
Live, unpredictable internet radio.
ACB Radio Interactive.